This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with singer and songwriter Sam Baker. Rolling Stone named Baker's latest album, Say Grace, one of the 10 best country albums of 2013. Although he's released 4 albums, Sam Baker didn't get serious about making music until later in life. Writing songs was a reaction to almost dying in a terrorist attack in 1986 when he was 31. He was on a train in Peru when a bomb planted by a terrorist group exploded in the luggage rack above him. The people he was sitting with were killed. Baker's body was torn apart. He suffered a brain injury, severe hearing loss, and required more than 15 reconstructive surgeries. And somehow, during his long recovery, songs started coming to him. When Terry interviewed Sam Baker earlier this week, she began by playing Baker's song, The Tattooed Woman.
The tattooed woman, she sleeps in my bed. The ink is dry, the dogs are fed. The moon is safe, her face is red. The tattooed woman, she sleeps in my bed. Her hair is black, her skin is white. She's pulled the sheets around her tight. I wish I had the right to comfort her as a husband might. Rain is coming, that's how it feels. 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 Sleep, the Lord out wandering with his sheep. There's oh so many souls to keep. Now I lay me down to sleep.
Sam Baker, welcome to Fresh Air. I really love that song. Is this a story about you or about someone else?
It's about someone else, but it was, there was a tattooed woman who was asleep in my bed, and the merge in that is. But there's an old hymn, an old Protestant hymn called Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silent. And I don't know the rest of the words. I mean, the rest of the words could be almost anything. I love the title and I love the melody. And the melody goes back to the 1600s. It's a French melody that was taken by someone who created that hymn. So what happened was that was an amalgam of really two songs. And the hymn part, I think, sounds almost like an Algerian chant. I don't know if I can even do it. It's like la 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 la.
I didn't realize that was like an old melody that you borrowed.
Yeah, that's probably 400 or 500 years old.
You know, that song has such a mood to it, and takes a really gloomy turn, to me anyways, and rain is coming, that's how it feels.
Right.
But as you pointed out to me earlier, because it's pouring here in Philadelphia as we record
exactly,
this,
right.
You pointed out that in Texas, where you live, where it's been very dry, rain is great.
Rain is a gift, a great and wonderful gift.
So when you sing rain is coming, that's how it feels, that's a good thing?
Right, it's not a foreshadowing. Now, the second verse is foreshadowing. Now I lay me down to sleep. The
yeah.
Lord out wandering with his sheep. Oh, so many souls to keep. Now I lay me. Now, that is, Terry, that's foreshadowing. The rain is coming. It's kind of, actually, in my world, it's positive.
So many of your songs are stories about other people,
uh-huh.
about other characters. Some of your songs about are about your story,
yes.
And they're just incredible songs. So I want to talk a little bit about your story and play some of those autobiographical songs. So let's talk about the terrorist explosion that
right.
blew your body up. Where were you going when you were on that train in Peru? What were you intending to do?
I had gone to I'd gone to South America with friends, and we were young. I guess I was almost 32, and we walked around and looked. And we went to Cusco, at a time of a celebration called the Inti Rami, I think it's what it's called. And then we got, the next day, got aboard a train for Cusco, which is where Machu Picchu, the beautiful ruins, are. And someone put a bomb in a backpack, a red backpack, on the car that I got on. And I was sitting by a German boy. His mother was across from him, and his father was knee-to-knee with me. You know, two people sit facing two people, and the bomb was on the luggage rack right above this poor woman's head. So the German boy and I talked for a second, and then I looked back, and the bomb went off. And it was probably not that good of a bomb because so much of the blast went straight up. I think if they had been able to flatten the blast pattern, it would have killed a lot. I think that day it killed six or seven different accounts say, but it did kill the woman. This boy's mother killed her real fast and really violent, and killed his father real fast and real violent, and then it killed him. But it took a number of hours for him to die. I didn't see that. I had a cut artery, and you know, had blown my ears in, and I was in a bad place. I thought I had a heart attack, and then an external voice, English, said, "You are accompanied by death. Death accompanies those around you." And at that point, I knew that that they were dead or dying, and I was dying.
But you heard a voice saying that?
I say I heard a voice. You know, but my lungs had collapsed because I was so close to the blast wave of the bomb. So I panicked initially when I couldn't breathe. And then this voice was, I say it's a voice, but it was more like a cellular, something that passed through on a cellular level so that it quieted all the, you know, at that point I became, I guess, willing to die, because I said to myself, well, if this is death, let's get about it.
I want to play the song that you wrote about the explosion. It's called Steel, as in the passenger train.
Right.
It's just I don't know. The song leaves me kind of speechless, but it describes the experience in poetry. So let's hear Steel. It's from Sam Baker's first album, Mercy, which was released in 2004.
Sitting on the train to Machu Picchu, passenger car explodes. There's not enough time to say goodbye, there's not enough time to know what's gone wrong. God have mercy, I believe my heart has failed. Smoke rises through a hole in the roof, the dead say fare thee well. I swear, doctor, don't you have anything like morphine for this pain? I swear, Jesus, take me now, cause I'm about to go insane. I'm looking back at the world as one who is leaving in a dream come right out of hell. The dead say fare thee well. No one is just an observer. The same bell tolls for the served and the server, for the strong, the weak, for the weary, for the brave. For everybody, right, come judgment day. Cause trains explode, steel flies, and the sisters ring the Catholic bells. Rises through a hole in the roof, the dead say, fare thee well.
That's Steel from my guest Sam Baker's first album, which was released in 2004. The album was called Mercy. And that song describes his experience when he was on a train in Peru and the terrorist group, the Shining Path, had placed a bomb in the overhead compartment and blew up.
It was just like
train.
A luggage rack. It wasn't even, you know, it was an old narrow gauge rail, so And I think the rack itself, you know, that the suitcase sat on, that became the shrapnel. I don't know if they even packed the thing with shrapnel. I mean, they could have killed the whole car full of people.
There's a line in the song, "Smoke rises through a hole in the roof, the dead say fare thee well." Did you see the smoke rising? Were you lying
on your
back at that time?
I didn't. You know, what I did do is when I finally got to Houston after a long, complicated rescue, the U.S. Air Force came in. And when I was in Houston, I had an old friend come in, and he said that I told him that I saw those things. But by that time, I had gangrene and renal failure.
So did the image come from your friend telling you?
It came from
that you told your friend?
Telling me that I had told him. That's where that image came from.
That's really interesting.
Well, he said that the dead... I went into whatever the Tunnel of Light is. I actually went into that, which was an interesting... It really was a light of shades of gray, and the light at the end was a tiny light, really not very big, but it was a light that was... It was like a returning, like I was returning and becoming some sort of liquid light. It was more like an ecstatic return, but ecstasy is not the right word. It was like a cellular becoming of something more powerful and beautiful than anything I've ever experienced. I don't think we have a word for it. We don't have a word for the. And you know, I grew up in a small prairie town. You know, going to church every Sunday up until I was 17 or so. Part of that was the heaven, hell, and this was only when I came out of it. I started thinking about, you know, it was a non-denominational dying. It's not like someone shows up to say, "Have you?"
Singer-songwriter Sam Baker speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with musician Sam Baker. He started getting serious about writing and recording songs later in life after he was almost killed in a terrorist attack in 1986. He was then 31 and traveling on a train in Peru when a bomb exploded in the luggage rack above him. The people he was sitting with were killed. Baker's body was torn apart. He had a brain injury and severe hearing loss. But during his long recovery, songs started coming to him.
There's another song I want to play. This is a song about suffering, about things that don't heal.
Right.
The song is called Broken Fingers. And, I mean, your fingers were broken.
Right.
Well,
what happened was shrapnel came in. You know, my hand was vertical, and so shrapnel came down and cut a channel down across the top of my hand. But... you know, for the most part, they just wrapped it up because, you know, I had so many other things that were life-threatening, and this was not life-threatening. So it was bandaged up for weeks and weeks, and when they finally unwrapped it, it was a mess. It was awful.
So let's hear the song Broken Fingers. Do you want to say anything to introduce it about writing it?
I was stumped. I didn't know how to describe. How do you describe instant death? You know, how you and I are in this beautiful quiet room, and then the world comes in. And really, even now, Terry, I think I write around it. I don't know that I've ever been able to write directly into the core of it. And that's where that song, you know, I was trying to, I've never been able to get at peace with the boy that was killed. You know, the
boy sitting next to you.
The boy sitting next to me. I mean, and that's when I was, and it was years after the thing happened that I and then I got that, how long ago was 16 years every day, of course I know. And then that goes in to some things don't heal. I mean, some things I've had to learn to live with.
And I love the way when you sing it, especially the second time, the emphasis is on the don't. Some things don't heal.
They don't.
Yeah.
They don't. And they don't close. There's no closure. There's no healing. There's no closure. It stays open for forever. And I think once, you know, like somebody killing that kid, or, you know, those are things that stay open. I don't know that the universe heals those things.
So let's hear the song. Yeah. It's called Broken Fingers, and it's on one of Sam Baker's previous albums, which is called Pretty World.
Well, how long? How long ago? It's 16 years every day. Course I know. Forget his face. Of course I don't. It's like a crystal vase, these broken fingers. Some things don't heal. I can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. These broken fingers. Forget his eyes, his silhouette. Of course I don't. Of course I don't forget there are blue eyes, a silhouette. There is a debt, it's a debt I don't forget. These broken fingers, some things don't heal. I can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. These broken fingers.
That's Sam Baker, songwriter and singer, from his album Pretty World. His latest album is called Say Grace. A couple of lines in the song we just heard, I can't wake up from a dream when the dream is real. After the explosion, the Shining Path bomb was planted in the train that you were traveling on in Peru. Did you think it was a dream?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was awful. It was surreal. It was... The moment it went off, from that moment forward, it was as if there was a different alternative universe, because I went from a living, connected thing, just like you and I have today, to something that was so completely inward, you know, where I couldn't breathe, and then the voice came, and then I went in and was moving down the tunnel, and then that went black, and then I woke up and saw... They were sewing me up, and the guy showed me the thread that was had some sort of silver, like lubricant. And at that moment, I thought, "Well, this is awful. I'm gonna go back to being unconscious." And then the next morning, when I woke up, it was a pretty gauzy world. I wore contacts, and they had my contacts out, so I couldn't see anything, and I was deaf. So, my ears were blown in, and I really couldn't see. And in that last moment before I really woke up to the new world, that was when the voice came back and said, "You are here to do something." And
tell us about that voice.
Well, it was the same voice that told me that you're accompanied by death. That death accompanies those around you. And even then, as beat up as I was and leaking blood everywhere, there was they had tried to stop all the blood. They had stitched everything up and stitched it up dirty, which is why I ended up with gangrene. And even then, I thought, like what?
This was in Peru still?
Yeah, still in Peru. That was in Cusco. They military evac'd us down to Lima, where we stayed. And the people in Lima were really lovely. The doctors were great. But, there was not much they could do. Gangrene had set in, and I had renal failure. So it was, a matter of time before... And gangrene is a really distasteful sort of thing. I mean, it smells bad. It's, I had gone from climbing and healthy to being on the verge of death, and death in a smelly, bloody way.
In one of your songs, you have the line, "Everyone is at the mercy of another one's dream."
Right.
And I don't know if you intended that to be about yourself, but that's how I hear it.
Yeah,
like,
right.
You were at the mercy. All the dead people from this bomb blast were at the mercy of this group's dream of what they were trying to accomplish.
Exactly. I mean, that the whole first record was so I could set that line up, so I could say, we are all at each other's mercy. Once again, empathy, empathy, empathy. We are all at each other's mercy. And if you have this dream of destruction, it's not going to come out well for all of us. And then, but see, at the first one I did that, and then did that because I felt like that was such an important thing to say. We followed that up with an 8-minute really beautiful rondo that says, you know, this is like a reflecting pool after that one line.
Well, the line is in your song Angels, which is from your album Mercy. Why don't we hear that song? And do you want to demonstrate anything on your guitar about that song?
Yeah, I can. You know, there were so many people that rushed in to help. You know, they saved me and they saved a lot of other people, and it was at risk to themselves. And then the Peruvians in Lima were so unbelievable. And, you know, I got blood transfusion after blood transfusion. I had holes everywhere. The back of my arm was gone. You know, my leg was open for like a foot and a half. They were pouring blood in as fast as it poured out. People were had so little regard for their own safety or for their own well-being. And that I found that all the way through. The military evac guys, the docs, and it was just... And it was, you know, the only way I could think of to describe how those beautiful impulses was that song, Angels Flutter Around a Heart. Love can heal, they softly call. When trouble comes to the ones she loves, her angels come. And I'm not sure what, you know, the paintings of angels with wings. I see this more as all those incredible people that whatever this well of goodness that's in people, it just poured out.
So let's hear your song Angels from your album Mercy. And this is the song that has the line, everyone is at the mercy of another one's dream.
Angels flutter around a heart. Love can heal, they softly call. When trouble comes to the ones she loves, her angels come. They ease our suffering, they heal our pain. Her angels come like healing rain. Love and angels conquer all like rain. Her healing angels fall. Love and angels conquer all. Her healing angels softly call, amen. Call a truce, call a war. Everyone is a bastard, everyone is a whore. Everyone is a saint, everyone is redeemed. Everyone is at the mercy of another one's dream. She is as suffering heals pain. Her angels come like healing rain. Love and angels conquer all like rain. Her healing angels fall. Love and angels conquer all. Her healing angels softly call, amen.
That's a song, Angels, from the album Mercy by my guest Sam Baker. His new album is called Say Grace. In 1986, he was one of the victims of a train bombing by the Peruvian guerrilla terrorist group, The Shining Path, and he barely survived that. And several of his songs are about that experience, including the one that we just heard. You know, the song refers to healing angels. Those were people that you thought of as being your healing angels?
Yeah, I mean, I think
the people who helped you in the hospital?
They were so amazing. Whatever goodness they brought was so powerful.
Did you have painkillers that were healing angels too?
Well, I did, but those particular healing angels, their wings darkened pretty fast.
How fast?
Fast.
Right. Was it hard to get off of them?
Yes. Yeah, I had trouble. Right. I was on so many pain meds and also booze, alcohol. You know, it's the recovery is a mix of pain, surgery, and boredom, and that's a terrible place when you have access to pain meds.
Right. Because you were such a physical person before the bombing, you know, mountain climbing and
carpentry.
Carpentry. you were forced to have a very unphysical life outside mm-hmm. of pain. I guess pain was the most physical part of
right.
your life, but
right.
certainly no real mobility for a while. No. So did that force you into having a more expanded interior life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And spending all the time with people that were really I spent a lot of time in ICU right at the beginning, and then later on, I was in recovery and then rooms. I went from an exterior life of a young man to the interior life of an old man who was mostly deaf, couldn't walk, with brain damage. And so the things I could focus on were the things and the people that were close by, and so many of the people that were close by were really in deep trouble. Some much more trouble than I was physically. There were a lot of people that bells would go off and they would wheel people out. So that became the interior life is how to process the new world.
What's your life like now, your daily life?
Simple. I live a pretty simple life. I try to live as regimented as I can live. There are certain rituals I do. I get up and meditate at first. I try to eat as simple as I can eat, whether I'm on the road or not. I try to live a pretty simple, structured life where I can help people where I can help them and maybe be of service at times, not all the time, and hope for the best.
We should play another song. And this is another one that I think is just kind of like a poem that's a hymn, or a hymn that's a poem. Totally non-denominational, but just about being in the moment and seeing the beauty of the moment. It's called Pretty World.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's a great song.
It's a lovely song.
Did you want to say anything about writing it?
In those days of once I was kind of getting through the worst parts of the surgeries and stuff, there were moments that were exquisitely beautiful. One of the things about seeing so much sorrow and so much suffering is that when there is an absence of suffering, sunlight off a rose is incredible.
Sam Baker, I'm so happy I know your music now. I found out about it pretty recently, and I'm so glad that it's part of what I know. it's so good. Thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Terry, thank you. This has been, it's been a pleasure.
So let's hear your song, Pretty World.
Before the sun, before the heat, before we untangle from our sheets, before this summer day unfurls, pretty world, before the paper is dropped at the gate, before our coffee, before we are late, for dreams are lost like midnight pearls. Pretty world, pretty world, pretty roses, pretty smile, morning light, pretty eyes, lazy curls, pretty world.
We're listening to the title track of Sam Baker's album Pretty World, which has been reissued along with his albums Mercy and Cotton. Baker's latest album is called Say Grace. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Before the traffic, before the jets, before...
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast, who has written a new graphic memoir, a memoir illustrated with cartoons, sketches, and photos. It's about the changing relationship Chast had with her parents during the last years of their lives. It was difficult for her and her parents to even talk about end-of-life issues, which is why the book is titled, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Chast's book is funny, heartbreaking, and unflinching in dealing with her parents' stubbornness and denial as they became frail and increasingly unable to care for themselves. And it's just as frank about her own feelings of guilt that no matter what she did, she wasn't doing enough. The book begins when her parents were still living in the Brooklyn apartment where Chast grew up, and follows them as they move into assisted living, have repeated stays in the hospital, and finally enter hospice. Her mother outlived her father and died in 2009 at the age of 97. Chast lives with her husband in Connecticut. They have two children who are now in their 20s.
Roz Chast, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love your new book, and I'd like you to start with a reading from not the absolute beginning, but toward the beginning of the book. And I'm going to ask you to also describe some of the cartoons that you've drawn to accompany the words.
All righty. I'll start now. Two things about my childhood. One, I was an only child, and two, my parents were a lot older than other kids' parents. And I have this illustrated with me. There's four kids, and they're each saying something. Your mom's old. She's like a zillion. Your dad's old, too. That means they're going to die soon. And even when they really were a zillion, they and I never talked about the future. And this is a drawing of my mother and my father. And my mother says, we're going to 100. And my father says, don't strain your voice, Elizabeth. Why tempt fate? And this is a drawing of, I guess, a cartoon Grim Reaper, you know, in the black cloak holding a scythe. And he says, what's this? The Chasts are talking about me. Why, I'll show them. As my parents and I moved inexorably into this future, I became more and more aware that at some point we were all going to have to deal with this aging thing. And there's a drawing of me standing a little bit behind my parents on the moving sidewalk of life. There's a little sign that says, caution, drop off ahead. But they weren't asking for help, and I wasn't volunteering. In 1990, my husband, our three-year-old son, and I, pregnant with our soon-to-be-born daughter, moved out of the city to the suburbs of Connecticut, where there was more space and greenery and good public schools. If doing right by our kids meant abandoning my then 78-year-old parents, so be it. The longer we were there, the more impossible schlepping into Brooklyn seemed. If they wanted to see us so damn much, let them make the trip. And there's a little drawing of my increasingly elderly parents with little tiny suitcases standing in the snow of Connecticut.
Thank you for reading, though. That was Roz Chast reading from the beginning of her new graphic memoir called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And it's about her aging parents and what it was like to try to take care of them in the years before they died. The illustrations and the text, it's such a wonderful mix of, like, funny and heartbreaking. And you can easily see as the reader how complex your emotions were. You know, a mix of, like, anger and sympathy and sadness and frustration. But I'm wondering if you kept journals at the time during your parents' last years of their lives, and if those journals were illustrated, and how much of what's in the book is work that you did at the time that the writing and the images describe, and how much of it was done in reflection, in retrospect?
Well, the book really is a combination of a lot of different things. Some of the pages are cartoons that I did at the time. Part of this is because I submit these groups of cartoons to the New Yorker. We call them batches every week. So some of them I turned in as part of my weekly group of cartoons for the editors to look at, like the one with the I think it was called A Rare Sex Talk, when my mother's telling me her theories about women and shoes. and this, you know, one of her friends who is well into her 80s, she always wears the highest heels and she's always surrounded by men. My mother's theory was that the higher the heel, the more available you were signaling that you were. And so that cartoon was done years ago. There were a few in the book, the Dirty Checkers one, which my father was a combination of actually two different things. That he had told me that when he was a kid, he got this like terrible infection once from washing a set of dirty checkers, which just for some reason, I don't know, it just seemed like really funny to me. Not like the infection part, but just that, I don't know, like the unlikelihood of getting an infection from washing dirty checkers.
It makes the whole world a frightening place, because if dirty checkers can nearly kill you, you can't really touch anything, can you?
No, you can't. You would think that somehow the checkers, how dirty could they be?
Really?
You know, I mean, like, you know, were they dropped into like a latrine in the middle of like Calcutta? I mean, what are we talking about here? But anyway, that cartoon also combined the dirty checkers talk with once we were sitting in the living room and he noticed our fireplace and he suddenly went into some whole talk about I can't remember who the writer was, but some disastrous – oh, about the avalanche and killing everybody. And because the people in the story are all sitting around a fireplace. And he just associated our fireplace to this story where people are sitting – maybe it's Nathaniel Hawthorne. They're sitting around a fireplace talking about, you know, what are we going to do in the future? Oh, I don't know. Maybe we'll do this. Maybe we'll do that. And suddenly, like, an avalanche comes and kills them all. And he just was, you know, he just, it was like that. He's associated, you know, he always had that at the top of his mind, stories like that.
You finally convinced your parents that they had to move from their Brooklyn apartment into assisted living. And they moved into an assisted living facility near you. So you were able to be a more active part of their lives. And it was a decent place. I mean, you shopped other places that you really didn't like, but it ended up being just really incredibly expensive. Talk a little bit about how the expenses mount up.
Oh God, it's a complicated thing because, on one hand, I just felt so awful thinking about the money, but it was terrifying when a parent goes to assisted living, it's really expensive and insurance doesn't pay for any of that. And if they have savings that they have sort of scrimped together, as my parents did, to see it sort of rushing out. I mean, my parents were born in 1912. They grew up in the Depression or graduated from college into the Depression. They, you know, kept track of every nickel that they spent. And these habits of frugality from having grown up so poor, you know, to having graduated in the Depression and never left them. They were frugal. They were very careful about money. They, you know, used everything up. My mother would take slivers of soap and put them in a washcloth and then sort of sew this little like soap bag out of the slivers of soap. To see all of that scrimping, just sort of like a Niagara Falls of expense at the end. There's a kind of black comedy to it too. You know, there I am thinking, but it's also, you know, oh my God, this is like $14,000 a month. And it's like, I could have had that money. And then you just think like, God, I'm disgusting. I am like the most disgusting person in the world, because at least, you know, they saved it and it's their money and it went to help take care of them.
Were you surprised by anything that you felt when your mother did die? And she was what, 97?
She was 97. I think it's just so surreal. Sorry. I think one thing about the night, that night that my mother died was, you know, when my father died, my mother was still alive. And I think when your second parent dies, there's that sort of shock that like, oh, man, I'm an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's also this relief. It's like, it's done. It's finished. It's over. Because I had felt for so many years that there was this sort of sense of going through this whole passage, this whole last part of their lives and all the, you know, emotional and practical difficulties of that. And when my mother died, it was like, for the most part, it's over. Of course, it wasn't completely over because, you know, then there's all these other nonsense things you have to deal with. But basically, it was over.
When a family member dies, like when a parent dies, especially after your second parent dies, you have to deal with the possessions that they left behind. And that's a really emotionally difficult thing to do, because you're seeing all the stuff that brings back memories, and then you're having to decide, what do you want to keep? What do you want to throw away? What do you want to donate? You had dealt with this, I think, before they died, like
yes.
when they moved from their apartment into assisted living. And
right.
it looks from your illustrations that your parents would have been semi-finalists on Hoarders. They wouldn't have made the final cut necessarily, but
right.
you know, they would have had a shot.
Oh, totally. There were no rat droppings, but they were on their way to rat droppings, I think. Maybe a few years down the road.
One of my favorite parts of your book, you have photographs of some of their stuff. You took all your mother's handbags and laid them out on the bed, and it covers like the entire surface of the bed. And it's a queen or king-size bed.
yeah, it's a king-size bed.
And I just had all these memories of like my mother's handbags and old handbags, just seeing this. And then you took pictures of her eyeglasses, like eyeglass frames from before your time, as she would put it.
Yeah.
And then a photograph of like what was in the medicine cabinet, and a photograph of what was left over in the refrigerator, and then photographs of like desks and beds and tabletops that just have like papers and stuff and magazines piled up like several feet high. Wow.
By the time my mother died, I had dealt with their possessions. There wasn't really much left, but when I moved them out of their apartment in which they'd lived from 1959 to, I guess, 2007.
Four rooms.
Four small rooms, yeah. They never threw anything away, and it was not like there was anything, quote, valuable, unquote. It was mostly just, you know, old beat-up luggage and typewriters and my father's old, you know, French textbooks. He was a French and Spanish teacher. And when I was going through the stuff, I would be in the apartment and I would think, well, okay, I want to keep this and I want to keep that. It was very surreal, very bizarre. And then at a certain point, it was like, I don't want anything. I want, like, the photo albums and a few things off the wall. And I started, like, putting stuff in garbage bags because I thought maybe I could do this myself. And I filled up a few of them, and it was like I had not even like done 1%. And I just finally, I wound up paying the super to empty it. And it was horrible in some ways because I just couldn't make any more trips out to Brooklyn to go through their It was just, I could not do it. I just had it. And sometimes I'm horrified when I look back on this. On the other hand, I think about something a friend of mine who had gone through something similar said, which was that if you don't think your children will be interested, don't keep it. And he's absolutely right. I mean, I feel much more conscious of how much stuff I have now and what are my kids going to do with my stuff once I die. And, you know, do I want more stuff in my house? Like, not really.
Did you feel this sense of futility? Like your parents had saved and saved and saved things, in part because they were hoarders and in part because they were so frugal having come of age during the Depression. And then they get sick and everything just gets put in hefty bags and that's it.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's kind of what I meant by like black comedy. I mean, the frugality, the, I don't know, maybe that's one of the things that happens when your parents die. You start to, well, I use this word in my book, that you see things, you see objects more like post-mortemistically.
And oh, yeah, I love, you made up that word, I think, post-mortemistically. Yes. But I really love that thought, like what's going to happen to this after I die? Is it worth having now?
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that I've like become, you know, a Buddhist or anything like that, but you can't help but look at stuff differently. Mm-hmm. Like, I used to like to go to thrift shops and secondhand shops, and I still do, but not to the same extent, because now I look at it, and a lot of times I look around and I think, ooh, dead people stuff. You know, this all came out of somebody cleaning out somebody's parents' apartment or house or whatever, and I didn't want it out of my parents' house, so why do I want it out of your parents' house?
When your parents were younger, did they enjoy reading your New Yorker cartoons? Did they get them? Did they ever try to talk you out of them or explain why your cartoons were not funny?
They didn't try to talk me out of doing them, but I think that my sense of humor was not their sense of humor.
Did they criticize your cartoons?
They didn't criticize them, although my father used to carry around this cartoon in his wallet, which was not mine. It was, I don't know who did it. It was in Saturday Review, and it was a guy sitting, lying on his psychiatrist's couch, and the gag line was, I feel inadequate because I don't understand the cartoons in the New Yorker. And, you know, at the drop of a hat, he would pull that out and show it to people. So I think that this was their way of telling me that they were very proud of me. They were very, very, very proud to have a daughter whose cartoons were in the New Yorker, but that they didn't really understand them. And then, of course, as they got older, there were references that they had no idea what I was talking about.
Well, so. Ross Chast, thank you so much for talking with us about your book and about your late parents. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Terry. Great to talk to you.
New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Her new graphic memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?